Welcome to Gay Mystery Podcast, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. Before my interview with David Lennon this week, we're going to hear from Justine, as always, with her weekly recommendation. Hello, Justine.
Hello, Brad. How are you?
I'm hot and sweltering, but I'll survive.
Yeah. LA is really in the midst of quite the heat wave now.
With the high humidity, reminds me of when I lived in North Carolina.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a sauna out there. So, you know, you're interviewing David Lennon, and I recommended the first book in his Michelle Duchesne, Sassy Jones, New Orleans Investigations, Quarter Boys, several months ago. So with any luck, then people will have picked that up already and read it, and the interview would be even that more, much more interesting.
Absolutely. We definitely talk about the series in the interview.
So here's what I got today.
Okay.
Yeah. Soldier Down, a Mahu investigation. It's book 13 in the Mahu investigation series by Neil Plaxey. And let me just say, it's book 13, Brad, and you don't have to start at the beginning. This works very, very well as a standalone book. He just covers just enough of the background that you don't feel like you're missing out on anything. He does a very good job of that. A lot of authors spend way too much time recapping stuff instead of just telling you what you need to know for this book. So feel free to pick this up. This is set in Hawaii. The main character, Kino, and this is going to be another hard word for me, as we know how I mispronounce it. But Kino Kaanapaka, Kaanapaka, yeah, I think that's the Hawaiian pronunciation.
You did better than, I'm sure you did better than, I'm terrible with Hawaiian pronunciations.
Yeah, well, he is a Hawaiian police officer, and his partner, there's a nice little side story about his partner, Mike, who's a assistant firefighter. They are co-parents with a lesbian couple with twins between them, a boy and girl set of twins. And so there is a nice B-plot about the challenges of raising children in non-traditional families, because at some point the kids come up and say, so we think that one of the dads should live with one of the moms and the other dad should live with the other mom, and we can still go between. And there's a challenge in your life that you never really would expect.
That would be tough.
But it's going to be tough. And then the A-plot is a great mystery. So one of the lesbian moms is off-end Congress, is taking over a stub year and up for re-election to her own first term. And she is under the mentorship of a very senior, high-profile congresswoman whose father died 50 years ago in Hawaii when he was a soldier on leave from Vietnam. And the congresswoman can't find any details, even though she's got access to the classified records. So she decides, oh, this great detective that this young congressman's talking about, he can solve this case. No pressure there. And somehow he gets assigned an FBI agent whose specialty is financial crimes. And they go down a rabbit hole that is remarkable. And it's real good old-fashioned police work and how particularly frustrating a cold case is. And they go down a lot of false paths, and a lot of the witnesses are dead. And it is just a wonderful investigation. And you follow the clues, and there's a lot of insight to particularly how it was like in the Vietnam War for soldiers. It also what it was like for gay men back then. And then, you know, as they find people still alive, they've all taken different paths in their lives in terms of how they lived out being a gay man in the decades since the late 1960s. So he's got this all woven together in a remarkable way. And it's just a great read. I sat down and it was one of those books where I read it straight through and didn't have any regrets for the time that I put in. And it's got an intriguing recommendation from me.
You got an intriguing recommendation.
Yeah.
Sounds like it the way
I think people would really like it. And if you really want to go back and read all 12 books before you get to this, well, I could see that being a worthwhile endeavor. But if you just want to pick up this one, you've got an interest in the Vietnam War era, or you like cold cases, this is good. All of his books are set in Hawaii, and all of his characters are typical of the mixed races that now inhabit the island of Hawaii. So it's just a great read.
Sounds like a good read. And a little escape to Hawaii for those of us that aren't there.
Who can't get there just yet?
Yeah, absolutely. You have anything from Requeer Tales this week?
Requeer Tales is really excited that Simple Justice by John Morgan Wilson is being released next week. This is a top mystery. It won the Edgar Award for Best First Novel when it first came out, and it has been rewritten, revised extensively by the author himself. And, you know, Christopher Rice is doing the foreword, and we are really pleased to bring out this powerhouse of a book.
Yeah, not many LGBTQ authors have gotten Edgar Awards. I would say it's very few.
Well, he was the first. He's one of very few, but he was the first.
Very nice.
Yeah, yeah. So pre-order that now on Amazon.
Available for pre-order. So yeah. Simple Justice, John Morgan Wilson.
That's right.
And the other was Soldier Down by Neil Plaxey.
Right. You got all the names right.
I know. I'm proud of myself.
Yeah. But you let me do the Michael Duchesne, Sassy Jones little trick there.
Yeah, even though David Lennon told me how to pronounce him, I always get it wrong.
Yeah.
So anyway, okay. Well, I'll see you next week.
Sounds good. See you then.
We're sponsored by Requeer Tales, preserving our LGBTQ literary heritage one book at a time. Check them out at requeertales.com. David Lennon's family moved a lot, but he considered his hometown to be Weston, Massachusetts, even though he was only there for 5 years of school. He's published 9 books. His most recent, Deja Vu, was published in May. He's a 5-time Lambda Award nominee and won the 2010 Lammy for Gay Mystery for his second book, Echoes. He and his husband, Brian, moved to Kennebunk, Maine 4 years ago. His primary occupation is graphic design and branding strategy. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me on, Brad.
Oh, it's good to have you on. So I've got to ask about your series, the Michelle Doucette, Sassy Jones, New Orleans Mystery Series.
Yep.
You've written 7 books in that series. Tell us about Doucette and Jones.
Okay. Well, when the series first starts out, they're homicide detectives who are partnered together. Michelle is gay. He was born and raised in New Orleans by a single mother who had some emotional issues, which definitely affected him. Professionally, he's established. His personal life is pretty much non-existent, and he's the sort of character who sort of prefers observing from the shadows because he's a little bit afraid of getting too involved and losing control in life. Sassy, who it's actually an ironic nickname that was given to her by her grandmother because she was such a serious, quiet little girl. Sassy grew up in the swamps in a tiny town in the Atchafalaya Basin, moved to New Orleans for college and never left. And she's sort of the emotional rock of the series. She's steady, she's calm, she's more mature. She's 15 years older than Michelle and definitely far more comfortable with her emotions. At the same time, she doesn't suffer fools. There's 7 books in the series. They're set over an 11-year period in book time. And although Michelle is the real main character, the focus does shift around a little bit. Some books are more Michelle-centric. Some, it's totally equal. And Echoes, which you mentioned, won the Lammy, is actually focused on Sassy. I think that even though Michelle's more main character, Sassy's definitely not a sidekick. You know, the series couldn't exist without her.
Well, despite your moving around, I don't think that you have lived in New Orleans, but you made it the setting for the series. Why there?
You know, when the idea for the first book came to me, I was on my way back from a vacation down in New Orleans, and I had met somebody who had just moved to the city. I started thinking about, you know, what his life was going to be like there. This strange idea popped into my head. I wrote down some notes, stuck in a drawer for 7 years. So when I decided to, I wanted to write for a long time, but when I finally started, I just automatically set the first book, The Quarter Boys, in New Orleans. But I was never thinking that it was going to turn into a series. And in retrospect, you know, it would have been a lot easier to write a series someplace where I'd actually lived, because I do a lot of research. And fortunately, I do have some friends down there who can make location suggestions, things like that for me.
What's one of the most interesting things you learned in your research?
Oddly, I didn't realize, and this actually sort of came up in the second book, that how much of the city has to be built up high, because, you know, they built it below the Mississippi River. So entire sections of it, you can't have basements. And unfortunately, I did have a basement in one of the books. So I learned you can't do that.
Well, in your latest novel, Deja Vu, did I get that correct?
Yep.
Okay. It's currently available to purchase. Why that title? Tell us about the story.
Okay. The last book in the series came out in, I think, 2012, 2013. And at that point, I thought I was done, that I completed sort of the story arc for the characters outside of the individual mysteries. So when I decided to go back to it, you know, obviously the known saying is déjà vu, already seen. And there's a big element of that in this book, because it takes place in the same setting as the fourth book, Blues Bayou. I bring back a lot of the same characters. So that made sense. But of course, being an author, I want to put a little clever twist on it. So I went with déjà vu, meaning already old. And part of that is that aging is a recurring theme in the book. Part of it takes place in a nursing home, but it's also an expression of my own fear in revisiting the series, because it was like, okay, is this smart? Has its time already passed? In essence, is it already too old that I shouldn't be doing it?
Now, some series, such as Jenna Ivanovich's Stephanie Plum series, she's written 27 novels, and I don't think any time has passed whatsoever. But you have aged your characters 11 years since you started the series.
Yep.
Do you have to be cautious developing a character over time in a series?
Well, you do. I mean, I personally think it's more fun to read characters who evolve. But, you know, a lot of people like comfort food. They like what's familiar. And so there's always the risk that you're going to go in a direction that somebody doesn't like. And they may just leave the series. Even if, you know, if they trust you, you may eventually bring it back to something they want. But, you know, one false move, you can lose readers.
Did you take marketing into account when you were deciding on the series?
No, I really didn't. You know, I wasn't thinking about marketing at all. I mean, as I said, wasn't even sure I was going to be doing a series. It was a good year and a half after the first book before I realized I might be able to do something with the characters again.
Well, you kind of touched on this quite a bit, but I want to go a little deeper. What are some considerations you have to take into account when writing a mystery series?
Well, I think one lesson I learned is you have to be really clear up front about what it is that you're writing. I hadn't read any other gay genre fiction before I started writing, so I wasn't aware of the conventions. And if I had been, I wouldn't have made the burgeoning relationship between Michelle and Joel so central to the first book, because it created the expectation for some people that I was writing MM. And that became a problem down the road when it was obvious that I wasn't going to deliver a happy ever after. The other thing is figuring out where your focus is going to be. Is it on the mystery? Is it on the characters? Is it on some sort of a combination? Because as you mentioned with the Janet Ivanovich novels, things happen in the character's life, but the character doesn't really change. And that's the same sort of thing with Sherlock Holmes or Agatha Christie's books. The focus is really on the mystery. But a series like, you know, either Henry Rios or the Benjamin Justice series, I would argue that the mysteries are almost secondary to what's happening in the personal lives of the characters. I mean, they're great mysteries, but they always are intertwined with what's happening in the personal lives of the characters, and they force the character to evolve. So I think you need to have an understanding of what it is you're hoping to accomplish with a series up front.
Yeah, and things have actually changed in that way over the years. I remember reading a rules for mystery, in air quotes, from the 1920s. And one of the things they stressed is the story is not about your characters. They don't want to know your personal life. People right. want the puzzle. So, interesting change.
Yeah, I remember having a discussion with Drew Wayne Gunn about that, that in a lot of the hard-boiled classic mysteries, there might be a dame who comes along, but the detective never gets emotionally involved.
Well, you talked about reading the gay mystery genre. Do you read much outside the genre?
I read mostly outside the genre. I mean, most of my reading is mystery, but probably 80% of it is not gay.
How does that benefit you?
I think that within any genre, and particularly subgenres, you have tropes that if that's all you're reading, you can start to believe those are requirements that you have to include in your plot. And so potentially we end up with the main character in every book being a sort of tormented loner who has a traumatic event in his past that keeps him from becoming emotionally accessible. So I think that if you're reading outside of it, you're going to see that there are other approaches into stories that you can have a wider variety of characters. You can stylistically approach things from a different perspective. I mean, not that all mysteries are stylistically the same, but you know, you can actually write parodies of mysteries or romances, which tells you that there are certain approaches that are pretty common. So I think if you read other things like, you know, some stream of conscious sort of fiction, how can you incorporate that into a mystery so that it makes it just a little bit more interesting or a little bit different?
Yeah, the stream of conscious writing is becoming very popular these days. Yeah. And interesting thing regarding tropes, before I really started writing, I took a course on writing, and it was given by the executive editor of a publishing house that I won't name. But she did it on her own time. And at first it was a good course, but then it became more and more obvious that she was saying, here are the slots, just fill them in every story and you'll have a book.
Oh, so she wasn't giving you cautionary tales. She was giving you a roadmap.
Yes, exactly. If you want to be published, here are the things that must occur. So I was very disappointed in that class, as I could say.
Yeah, that would be kind of boring.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's time for awkward questions authors get.
Okay.
And you'll need to step back while I spin the wheel.
Okay. Now, is this a real wheel that you have in your house?
Oh, of course. Price is Right has nothing on my wheel.
I guess podcasts pay really well.
I wish. Okay, well, here we go.
Okay.
Okay, your question is one of those that's a little blunt. How come I've never heard of you?
Okay, well, now I know you don't have a real wheel because you could not have found a more appropriate question for me. I think it's squarely on me. You know, when I started writing, well, when I started publishing, I did make an attempt to send out review copies. I put up a Facebook page as an author, and I tried to establish some relationships within Book World. But I'm not comfortable with it. And what I discovered is I was really bad at keeping up the Facebook page because I had nothing to talk about. It's like, oh, I'm writing. Oh, book's coming out. Ta-da. So I stopped making the effort. I really admire the authors who get out there and make connections and sell themselves. I don't think that that's a bad thing at all. In fact, you know, I encourage my clients to sell themselves all the time. That's what how I make my money. But I just have a tough time doing it when it comes to writing. It's like I finish a book, and as far as I'm concerned, that's it. I don't really think about them again. I should, but it's a lost opportunity.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how much a Facebook page or a group really helps. I think it's a piece of the pie.
Right. You have to have some sort of social media presence, I believe, and I don't have any at all.
Yeah, but if you look at some of the really popular authors and look at the number in their groups, their numbers look staggering. But then when you divide it by the number that probably read their novels, you really see that they're reaching out to a very small group of people that I presume is part of their thing. But again, as I said, I think it's a piece of pie. There's a lot of other things that need to go with marketing. And as writers, we generally do not like marketing.
No. I mean, it's, you have to create, unless you just have unless you have an amazingly engaging personality naturally, it's difficult to do. It's almost like, okay, I have to put on author face now. And what is that?
Yeah, and I've seen some courses on author marketing, and those are probably worth more time than the one I spent on how to write a novel or how to write a mystery novel.
I mean, I have to say, though, after listening to Cheryl Head on your show, I just found her so engaging that I immediately bought her books.
She'll be happy to hear that. She actually was a lot of fun to talk with.
She was
an easy conversation. Now, you've written a couple of standalone novels, but you've primarily focused on Michelle Doucette and Sassy Jones over the years. Can we expect a new series down the road?
I don't know about another series. I've had an idea that I've been kicking around for a long time. It's set in the 70s. The main character is a young woman cop, but I don't know if I have it in me to develop it right now. You know, my writing is really slowed down. I used to be able to get the first draft done in a couple of months. Now that it's like 2 years. So I don't know, but there will definitely be more books in the Michelle Sassy series and maybe a few other one-offs.
You work full time and you've published 9 novels over the years. You kind of said you are holding back a little bit. How are you able to balance your job with your writing?
It's difficult. I am pretty good at maximizing time. So, you know, when I wake up in the morning, unless I've got email waiting for me that has to be taken care of for work, I'm good at blocking everything out for a few hours until I get my writing done. It's purely an illusion that I was at all prolific because, it's 9 books in 10 years, but written over 13 years, and there have only been 3 books in the last 6 years. So it's not as difficult to balance the time anymore because I'm not writing nearly as much.
I don't know whether it's true, but I heard recently that the typical writer who writes a series or wants to write more than just a novel, they stop at 3 for whatever reason. Now, I don't know if that's true, but if that is true, you've beaten them.
Wow. Almost 3 times over.
Yes, you are. So good on you. Do you read your reviews?
No, I don't. I did in the beginning, but even the good reviews never said the things that I hoped they would. You know, when you're writing, you know what goes into it. You know what your intentions are. You know the things that you hope people will recognize. And when they don't, and they focus on something else, even if it's great, it's like, oh God, how come they didn't see that I did that? And then, of course, you're always going to remember the bad reviews way more than the good ones. So I just found it was making me not feel good about being in book world.
Yeah, and it really can bring you down. And I learned now from those who have gone before me that not to read my reviews, but allow somebody to read them and give me a synopsis of what people are saying.
Well, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, if there's a reoccurring conversation that's going on, that can be good. But don't read them yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously see the value in criticism, you know, particularly if you're missing the mark on something with your books over and over again, then you should take that into account. But so much of the criticism that you see on things like Amazon, it's so subjective. And oftentimes the people just don't seem to know what it is they're getting into. It's like, oh, there's too much gay content in this book. Like, well, it's a gay book. What were you expecting?
Yeah, I had another interview with someone who said they were criticized because the book was, it was a gay novel. They were criticized because the book was too male. I don't even know what that means.
I don't either. You can't be too male as far as I'm concerned.
Well, me either. So you've been nominated quite a few times for the Lammies.
Yep.
And you won once.
Mm-hmm.
But you told me that the Lambda Awards have changed over the years, that they used to have a set number of nominations, but they changed it based on the number of nominations.
By the number of submissions now, yeah.
Yes, the number of submissions that they get, they'll change the nominations based on how many they get submitted.
Yep.
What are your feelings regarding that decision?
A part of this comes from what I do for a living, which is, you know, the branding side of things. You know, if you're going to position yourself as the most prestigious literary award, LGBTQ literary award, I think you have to be really careful to make sure that everything that you are promoting, anything that you're putting your stamp of approval on, is really worth it. And that starts with making sure that you have enough judges and that they're qualified, and then just making sure that the only books that get nominated are the ones that should. So as soon as they jumped from, I think it used to be 3 to 5 nominations, and then they went to some sort of a percentage. So, you know, I've been a judge, and the year I was a judge, I think there were 41 submissions, and they told us we had to come up with 8 finalists. And there were 5 books that we all thought were great, and then there were 3 that it was like, they're okay, but we have to nominate them because that's what they've told us. And so now as a nominee, because I think I've been nominated twice since then, it made me wonder, you know, was this really that good? Or was I one of the, okay, good enough sort of people? So I think that it's damaging for credibility purposes, even though I'm sure that, you know, you have more nominees, you can sell more tickets, and obviously they need to bring in money. So I do understand it from a strategic standpoint, but I think it devalues the award a little bit.
When you judged, was that for the Lambda Literary?
Yes.
You kind of touched on it, but share that experience.
It's a lot of work. I mean, actually, the year after I won for Echoes, they reached out and asked me if I wanted to be a judge the following year. And I guess that's how they used to find the judges. They would look at the pool of people that were nominated the previous year and see if they could get some of them to participate. So at that point I was submitting a book that year. So I didn't do it then. But a couple of years later, I was contacted and asked if I wanted to be a judge. So then I said, sure, you know, you guys have been very good to me. I feel like I should give back. But it's a difficult process because it's a lot of books. You don't have a ton of time to read them. So you do have to kind of skim through a little bit and then figure out, you know, after 20-25%, whether you have the time to continue with a book or whether it's obvious that the quality is just not there. And then the actual judging process, from what I hear, it differs from group to group. I mean, we put together, all of the judges put together their comments onto a spreadsheet, assigned grades, and then we actually went through them, had discussions, figuring out, you know, who our top choices were.
Well, it's an awfully big commitment as a writer if you're reading 41 books, which I can't imagine because you have only a certain amount of time, to read that many and try to do your own thing. It's been very difficult.
I decided that I would not write during that time period.
Yeah, I don't see any other way.
And I'm blown away. Some of the categories, you know, it's like women's romance. You know, they have 100 submissions some years. It's like, how do you possibly get through that?
I would have no idea. What novels do you believe are underappreciated?
Well, I wouldn't say necessarily underappreciated because she's gotten a lot of awards and I guess she sold a lot of books back home, but I don't know too many people outside of Scandinavia who read Anne Holt. And I think that her Hanna Willumsen series is amazing. It's, I think 10 books. She started publishing them in 93 and the most recent was 2016. The main character is a lesbian detective inspector in Oslo. She's brilliant. She's abrasive. Sometimes you just want to scream at her. And then the next minute she does something totally endearing. And what I love about the series is the evolution of the character, that she does age in time. So, you know, you're talking about a 23-year period where she loses a wife to cancer, gets into new relationships, ends up in a wheelchair. And I think it's the 8th book, which was oddly the first one published in English, is first person. The rest of the series is third person. So it's great because in that one book, you actually get inside Hani's head, because oftentimes you're wondering, what is she thinking? And you finally get to find out what she's thinking. And it's so cool.
Yeah, I've never heard of an author doing that, writing it from one perspective and then change it in the next novel. That's interesting that she did that.
Yeah.
A similar situation with one of my favorite authors is Lawrence Block. He's not a gay mystery author, but his novels, if you talk to other writers, they know him, and he's won numerous awards, including the Edgar Award. But when I talk to the general public, nobody's ever heard of him. So it sounds a lot like Anne Holt. They're getting the accolades, but for whatever reason, they're not getting enough people that know who they are.
Yeah, well, I also wonder about Val McDermid. I mean, the year that I won the Lammy, she also won for Lesbian Mystery, and she got the Lifetime Achievement Award. But I had never heard of her before then, and her books are wonderful. And her Carol Jordan Tony Hill series has been made into the TV series Wire in the Blood. But I still don't know anyone else who reads Val McDermid.
Are there any queer mystery writers that have inspired you over the years?
I can't say initially because I wasn't aware of them. You know, I hate to say it because it sounds really stupid and egotistical, but when I decided to write a gay mystery, I thought I was coming up with something totally new. And then when I started looking for publishers, I discovered that, oh, there are these other books out here. There are these other people. So I think I was already old enough. I was in my 40s at that point. How old was I then? Like 45. So I think that your writing is formed earlier, or you're being inspired to be a writer obviously happens earlier. That said, once I started reading the canon, you know, Joseph Hansen and John Morgan Wilson and Michael Nava and R.D. Zimmerman, that really inspired me. It did. You know, it didn't necessarily change the way I wrote, but I just thought, wow, these books are so good and they go so much deeper than what I would have expected. So that inspired me. And then when that damn Marshall Thornton came along, that inspired me too, because I'm kind of competitive. And so when something that good came along, I tried to raise my game.
Yeah, I do the same. I look at those that have won awards or are doing extremely well. And like you said, I don't try to plagiarize, but it definitely encourages me to improve my writing skills.
Yeah. Yeah. And Jeffrey Round inspires me too. I think he's very good. And Gary Ryan, his Detective Lane series.
Well, I had a very similar journey. I wanted to write a mystery with a gay character, and I didn't know it existed either. And what happened in my case was I started writing towards male-male romance novels because I thought that's all there was. Mm-hmm. And I was going to allow my mysteries has always been my thing. So I was going to allow my character to have a mystery, but I felt like to get anybody to read it and enjoy it, I was going to have to go the male-male route. And yeah. it took me forever to write that novel. And I ended up not writing that novel once I learned others are out there, such as yourself and other writers. And I ended up having to redo the whole novel from a genre that I wanted it to be because I learned, hey, other people are doing it.
Yeah.
So I was very grateful for that.
Yeah, I wish I'd known earlier what was out there. I owe a lot to Drew Wayne Gunn. He was sort of my guru in introducing me to what had come before me.
Well, David, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. As always, that 30 minutes goes by so fast.
Thank you so much for having me on, Brad.
I appreciate it.
I appreciate it too.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.